Welcome to Dev News, the news show for developers by developers, where we cover the latest in the world of tech. I'm Saranya Barak, founder of Disco.
And I'm Josh Pitts, principal engineer at Forum.
This week, we're talking about Twitter NFT profile pictures and some stories about U.S. government versus big tech.
Then we'll speak with Ellen Fitzsimmons-Kraft, assistant professor of psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, about a research paper she co-authored about how the use of chatbots could help prevent and mitigate eating disorders.
Eating disorders are really a major public health concern. These are very deadly psychiatric illnesses. They're the second most deadly of all mental disorders, only following opioid use disorder.
Then we speak with Miroš Brojo, general manager at Slovak Game Developers Association, about a wealth of unearthed Slavic text adventure games from the 80s that he and his team have translated and featured at the Slovak Design Museum.
There is another game about stealing half of the recipe of Pepsi-Cola, which is another example of how the Western culture was already slowly spreading in the East, even before the fall of the socialist regime.
We can't seem to get away from NFT news this season, because this week, Twitter launched a new feature that allows their paid Twitter Blue users to show off one of their NFTs as their profile picture in a new hexagon-shaped profile picture box. So, for $2.99 a month and whatever probably absurd amount you paid for an NFT, you can now be a verified NFT owner on Twitter. However, even though Twitter uses OpenSea's NFTs authentication system, some users have bemoaned that people can simply right-click on the NFT profile picture, save the image file, mint it as a new NFT, and then upload it without actually owning the original NFT. One of my favorite quote tweets about this is by author Casey Johnson, who pokes fun at somebody complaining about this, saying, quote, "NFT guy finding out NFTs are just JPEGs never gets old," end quote. There have also been a slew of apps that allow people to easily recreate the new hexagonal profile picture box for any image they upload. So it looks like Twitter might have some tweaking to do in order to appease the NFT bros who want to show off their crypto wealth. Josh, what do you think about all this?
I'm sorry, can you guess? Okay. So snarking aside, this is one of the first like actual concrete benefits I can point to from buying an NFT. Like in theory now, you can get a special icon on Twitter if you also pay for Twitter Blue. So, I mean, that's something. It would also seem to point to like, you know, Twitter must think that the NFT market is legitimate, that it's here to stay, it's worth supporting. It seems like kind of a random feature, though, wouldn't you say? Like of all the features that would get me to pay $2.99 a month for Twitter Blue, I don't know that NFT profile pics was the one. Like if they added, you know, I don't know, like editing my tweet after I posted it, like I'd give them $50 a month for that, but they're never going to give us that.
Yeah, this was confusing for several reasons. Number one, because frankly, I forgot all about Twitter Blue, just to be honest. So I was like, okay, there's a benefit to something that they're trying to, you know, use to monetize Twitter. Cool. So that was a nice reminder. But the thing that was so confusing to me is, you know, we have so many complaints about our social media experience, whether it's edit on the Twitter platform or, you know, protecting people from harassment or the spread of fake news. I mean, there's so much to think about and prioritize when it comes to creating a safe and exciting and welcoming social media platform that it is confusing that this made the roadmap and then was implemented. You know what I mean? Like, that's the part that made me go, how did this product conversation go? You know, like you're on the engineering team and you're like, of all the things people have asked for Twitter, people have issues and problems on Twitter and all that. You know what sounds really important? We should really make sure we get out there. NFT profile pics. That's
well,
the one.
Well, I will say that Twitter's a large company. They have tons of engineers working on, I'm sure, a variety of features. And I don't think it's a zero-sum game, right? Like, I don't think all of their engineers work on this and all their engineers going to work on
something else. Right,
of course. Right. Also, I think the conversation, maybe it wasn't started by an engineer, an engineering team. Mm-hmm. Like, until very recently, someone at Twitter was very interested in NFTs and cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. Jack Dorsey, noted crypto enthusiast and former head of Twitter, was very, very involved in NFTs and crypto. And here's my conspiracy theory. Remember a couple weeks ago when Square changed their name to Block, and that was accompanied by the most ridiculous and lovely profile pics on their leadership page with their images in blocks? If you flatten those blocks to 2D, they look like hexagons. There you go. There's my conspiracy theory.
All right. I think that makes a lot of sense to me. I buy it.
I think maybe this was like a top-down kind of a thing. Maybe this is already in process before they left, but it's a little confusing. On the other hand, I like the pace that Twitter's adding features. They're doing things again.
They are doing things.
Yeah. I'd rather they throw this stuff at the wall and see what sticks with users. And I've got no problem with a service that you could pay to remove some of the ads and get extra features. More power to them. I'm up for it.
That's true. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, when I hear about a big organization like Twitter that does not have, you know, NFT origins, like it's, you know, it's not an NFT company, it's not a crypto company, it's a social media platform. When they're getting involved in NFTs, it kind of makes me wonder just about the different roles that different institutions and different, you know, people with power have in legitimizing the NFT market. You know, like that's what I think about is, you know, right now we're seeing a ton of celebrities like get involved, right? And they've been called grifters and they've been called scammers. And they're like, oh, you're already rich and you're trying to like make more money from your, you know, your audience. And, you know, it's not necessarily seen as like very highly of those people to be involved in NFTs when they like declare their crypto interest. But when it's like companies getting involved, like, what does that mean? You know, what does that mean for the future of NFTs? Is it legitimizing it? Is it still kind of shady? Like, how does it affect the future of this world? It's something I'm really interested in keeping an eye on.
This is a big stamp of legitimacy. And for a lot of people, this is the first time they will encounter NFTs. Well, I mean, in theory, I think if you're on Twitter, you have to work pretty hard not to see the letters that's NFT across your timeline. But this may be something that spurs some users to say, oh, NFTs, how can I get a cool or different profile pic shape? Similarly, like how Twitter added the verified mark on some users' profiles for a while. There was a huge rush to try to get your profile verified. And what does that mean, et cetera, et cetera. This could be something similar.
Absolutely.
So the next thing we want to talk about are a couple of stories about the U.S. government versus big tech. The first is about a piece of legislation called the American Innovation and Choice Online Act that was advanced this week through the Senate Judiciary Committee on a 16-6 vote. The act would prohibit big tech companies like Amazon, Meta, and Apple from discriminating against smaller businesses that rely on their services. For example, the companies couldn't rank their apps and products higher in a search over third-party apps and products. The large companies who this would affect would be defined by their market cap and how many users they have. There's been massive lobbying by big tech companies against the act, and Apple CEO Tim Cook also brought up concerns that this might affect how the company allows its users to opt out of being monitored by apps. We'll see if the legislation passes with the full Senate, but given how bipartisan this initial vote was, it's definitely looking like it might. The next story we want to talk about is how Google's being sued by three states in the District of Columbia, claiming the company has purposely created deceptive language and complex settings around its Android location tracking functionality. The Washington, D.C. complaint states that Google purports to, quote, give consumers control over the location data Google collects and uses. But Google's misleading, ambiguous, and incomplete description of these settings all but guarantee consumers will not understand when their location is collected and retained by Google or for what purposes, end quote. So we just kind of wanted to wrap these two government legal stories together as there's a lot of action happening in the U.S. government against big tech. And I think for a while we didn't see a lot of action, or we saw a lot of like, you know, big showy grandstandy.
I feel like there's a congressional hearing like every other day.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, cool. Okay. So then what? Like, what happens now? Now that we've we've heard, okay, now that we've heard and we've learned, you know, what do we do with this? And it felt like nothing was really happening. And especially with the Senate, that's a vote that is, you know, against, you know, big tech. And that's very interesting. So, you know, still early days, but really interested to see that maybe there's some action happening, not just a lot of, you know, leaks and reports and conversations and feelings, and maybe some actual legislation might come out of things. That could be interesting.
It's interesting to me that as the number of congressional hearings has continued, CEO attendance has dropped sharply at those events. You know, Zuckerberg's not even remoting in anymore. They're sending, you know, I don't want to use the word underlings. They're sending subordinates. They're sending, you know, associate vice presidents and other like executives in place of the CEOs to patiently explain to Congress once again what it is these companies do. And I think as we've seen that happen, I wonder if United States lawmakers are getting the idea that, like, you know, grilling a CEO in front of television cameras doesn't do much. Actually passing laws is what's going to happen. The thing that stood out to me about these laws is that there's bipartisan support. And for our listeners that aren't in the United States, that's pretty rare nowadays that our two political parties agree about anything. So it seems like the stuff's on a pretty good track to get passed. What do you think about that?
You're absolutely right. It feels like, you know, our political parties agree on less and less every day, which is very disheartening. And, you know, they're always on polar opposites of every issue. And even when I think about big tech regulation, like what comes to me is more of the Democratic Party. Like Elizabeth Warren is very top of mind when it comes to that conversation. And so it was really interesting to, you know, read up about this and see a lot of Republicans that are like, yeah, man, you guys have too much power. Like, we got to do something about that. And so seeing that it's, you know, a lot of folks on both sides of the aisle having an opinion and taking a stand, I thought was, you know, whether or not something actually happens, the fact that they're finally coming together on something is kind of heartening.
Yeah, it points out to me, I just think like, wow, it must be really bad if two political parties could agree that, you know, there needs to be clearer language for consumers and limits on the power. That's a sign that you've gone too far.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming up next, we talk about how chatbots could help prevent and mitigate eating disorders after this. Here with us is Ellen Fitzsimmons-Kraft, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, and co-author of the research paper, Effectiveness of a Chatbot for Eating Disorders Prevention, a Randomized Clinical Trial. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us about this paper. What was the objective behind the study?
The main objective of this study was to test whether a computer program that simulates conversation with a human could significantly reduce eating disorder risk factors like weight and shape concern and internalizing what we refer to as the thin ideal, you know, that I should aspire to be, you know, ultra thin and look a certain way in women who were already at high risk for an eating disorder. So they were already, you know, demonstrating some of those elevated concerns about shape and weight or other indicators of an eating disorder. And we tested, you know, whether that chatbot was more effective in reducing those risk factors among women who received access to the chatbot right away versus those who were randomized to what we'd call a waitlist control condition. So they were told and provided they'd get access to the chatbot at the end of the study.
I'm curious, what was the inspiration behind the study?
So along with my research group, we've been doing work for quite some time on digital programs for eating disorders prevention and treatment. And eating disorders are really a major public health concern. These are very deadly psychiatric illnesses. They're the second most deadly of all mental disorders, only following opioid use disorder. So for that reason, these are, you know, problems that are really important to prevent in the population. And we've done some work showing that we could use a digital intervention to prevent these problems in young women. But we've found in the past that, you know, those programs were more effective if they involved a human moderator, you know, so somebody who could provide you some, you know, feedback on your progress in that program, who could help you think about how to apply some of those concepts and skills that you're learning in your daily life, et cetera. But of course, anything with humans involved is more expensive, right? That becomes a less scalable kind of program. And unfortunately, you know, here in the US at least, there's not a lot of resources put toward prevention of mental health problems. You know, that's not like reimbursable in most cases. And so, you know, we were kind of thinking about, you know, how could we creatively think about how to provide some aspects of human moderation in a digital program, but in kind of this less expensive, more disseminable way. So that's where we got to thinking, you know, about a chatbot and, you know, this idea that kind of this robot could not only provide you that digital eating disorder prevention program in a more, you know, engaging format, kind of, you know, via your text messages and, you know, short bits of information, but that that chatbot could also, you know, offer some aspects of human moderation. So that was really kind of the inspiration for the current study.
Tell us a little bit about the methodology of it. How many participants were there? Where did you end up finding them, recruiting them?
So for this study, we recruited 700 women who are at high risk for an eating disorder, and they were mostly recruited through social media, through our partners at the National Eating Disorders Association. We recruited some through their online screening tool. So that was the main strategy that we used for recruitment.
So let's talk about the chatbot that you used for the study. I'm curious, how was it created and what kind of conversations did it have with the participants?
So the chatbot was based on, you know, as I mentioned before, we had this existing eating disorders prevention program that, you know, in past years and studies was delivered via kind of like a traditional web-based program, you know, so information you could view on a browser, you know, in a session that might have taken, you know, 20 minutes to read through, which I think, you know, at the time this was first developed, probably now, you know, 20 years ago, I think individuals maybe had patience for that, reading information on a browser, right? This was kind of like before mobile apps had taken hold, you know, reading longer information. But of course, now everybody, you know, wants to do a million things in no time. So what we did was take the content of that web-based program and really distill it down to its essential components and rework it for delivery in a conversational form with this chatbot. So, you know, the chatbot had text-based information it was providing. We also created some infographics to convey, you know, some of the concepts that we wanted to get across, and covered content like challenging the thin body ideal, you know, thinking about sort of beauty and attractiveness in a broader fashion. Ideas about media literacy and social media literacy, and how we, you know, need to keep in mind that not everything that we see in the media or on social media is really a reflection of reality. Information about the idea of social comparison and healthy eating and how to engage in eating habits that can really set you up for health versus making you more vulnerable to disordered eating. You know, how to deal with critical comments from others about your body, how to address any engagement in binge eating, and then, you know, some ideas for how to keep this work going even after the program was over. So it was all really done in these like short conversations with the chatbot, you know, 5 to 10 minutes max.
And is the idea that the participants knew it was a chatbot and kind of knew they were talking to a computer, or was it supposed to simulate, you know, a person and kind of, you know, trick them into thinking it was, you know, a live person that they were talking to?
Yeah, good question. No, we certainly didn't have the intention to trick them. And I think, you know, folks could have probably figured out pretty quickly if we tried to do that, you know, similar to any of us, if we reach out to like a store or, you know, you get that chatbot, you know, it's not a real person. So, you know, it can do like pretty well, but obviously it's not perfect. So no, they knew it was a robot. And, you know, there has been some research to suggest that actually, you know, engaging with chatbots and robots, because they are totally anonymous, you know, can encourage really honest disclosure, you know, maybe of issues that you wouldn't be willing to share with a real person. And, you know, for those who engaged with the chatbot, we were pretty impressed by some of the, you know, deep things that they would share. So for some people, you know, they may have never talked with anybody in their lives or a professional about these issues, you know, and maybe this chatbot, this robot was the first place they were expressing these concerns, but it gave them that, you know, opportunity to try doing that in a safe space and maybe even see that that's not so bad, which, you know, we didn't gather data on this in this study, but in others, I think there's even some idea that, you know, these kind of anonymous digital interventions, you know, can help break down stigma that you may have about getting mental health help and maybe make you more likely then to reach out to a real person.
And what were the results of the study?
Pretty promising overall. We were pretty impressed. You know, so for weight and shape concerns, we did find that, you know, women who received that chatbot right away did improve in that area more so than the control group at both 3 months after they received the chatbot, and that finding persisted through a 6 month follow-up period, which we were pretty impressed by. We also found that, you know, some indication that the chatbot may actually prevent the onset of eating disorders. So we found, you know, greater odds of, you know, not converting to an eating disorder case, if that makes sense, in individuals who receive that chatbot versus control at both that 3 and 6 month follow-up period. So overall, you know, we were pretty impressed by that. You know, we didn't find differences in changes in internalizing the thin ideal between our conditions. And we also didn't find changes in comorbid symptoms that we didn't directly address, like depression or anxiety. But I think, you know, overall, you know, the chatbot did reduce what we really hoped would reduce, which is those weight and shape concerns, you know, kind of being our primary target.
You mentioned it briefly before, but I wanted to come back to one of the specifics of the study. I'm curious how you control in a study like this. Is it some people got a chatbot with unhelpful suggestions? Some people got a human response? I'm really curious what the control looks like.
Yeah. No, great question. And, you know, this is always a question that researchers have to really think through for their study. You know, what's going to be the best control condition for my study? You know, who am I going to compare my individuals who get my intervention to? And in this study, our control condition was a waitlist control. And so that means that, you know, those individuals were told that you'll get access to the chatbot in 6 months. And we did end up doing that. But basically for the whole period of time that we're assessing them, which was, you know, at baseline, at 3 months, at 6 months, they'd never gotten any kind of chatbot content. So we're kind of comparing it to nothing, if that makes sense, which I think in this case was a fair comparison because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, prevention is pretty hard to come by. Most people don't get access to a, you know, an intervention to prevent their eating disorders because of, you know, kind of, again, issues of reimbursement and access to care. And so that represented for us a pretty good, like, real world comparison.
That makes sense.
So I'm curious, what were the takeaways? What do you think the results of this study show about eating disorders and society in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, eating disorders are common. It didn't take us too terribly long to recruit for this study. You know, these individuals are out there and, you know, risk for eating disorders is highly prevalent. You know, and while our sample was primarily, you know, white, non-Hispanic, we did recruit, you know, a good number of individuals from, you know, various racial and ethnic backgrounds and, you know, demographic characteristics. So I think that further demonstrates, which is consistent with the rest of the literature, that eating disorders really don't discriminate. You know, they affect individuals of all, you know, demographic groups. So certainly, you know, our results kind of do fit with that. And, you know, again, I think it also suggests that, you know, individuals do want access to help with these concerns, and that they were pretty accepting of this pretty brief, you know, totally automatic intervention. So I think it suggests some really good potential for, you know, chatbots to function in this capacity. I also think that probably similar chatbots could be developed for other problems, you know, individuals who are at risk for depression or anxiety or other mental health concerns. So I think it really suggests kind of an openness to technology. And those were some of the big takeaways for me.
You bring up a great point. I was going to ask, do you think there's other types of health intervention these chatbots would be useful for as well?
I do. And the research in this area, you know, is just starting to explode. You know, there's new papers, you know, coming out every day. And within the industry space as well, you know, I think there's continued enthusiasm for chatbots. We partnered with an industry partner, X2AI, who develops and delivers chatbots for various mental health issues. So it was really exciting to work with this commercial partner, which is going to then lead to opportunities for our team to disseminate this widely. And actually, our study was funded by the National Eating Disorders Association, which is the largest nonprofit dedicated to eating disorders in the US. And we work with them to also do screening for eating disorders on their website. So, you know, through their site, we screen about 200,000 people a year for eating disorders. So we really reach, wow, you know, very high volumes of people. And, you know, if people come to their website to take a screen, you know, perhaps unsurprisingly, the vast majority, you know, screen positive for an eating disorder or having risks for an eating disorder. And most have never received any kind of help. You know, over 85% of people have never had any kind of services. And so we're going to be able to work with NIDA and X2AI to actually make this chatbot publicly available through NIDA and pair it with the screen. So for individuals, you know, whose screen is having risk for these problems on their screen, they'll have access immediately to an intervention that could be helpful to them. So that's super exciting. And, you know, I think that moving forward, there's lots of opportunities to do similar work in other areas of mental health, pair chatbots, especially with available screens, you know, to immediately deploy interventions to individuals who need help. I also think that chatbots, I think, are really good in particular when they have a defined purpose. You know, so right now, you know, our chatbot was primarily a rule or algorithm based chatbot. So it could understand some basic text, but it couldn't understand everything. And we are taking steps to, you know, work with a colleague at Dartmouth, one of my co-authors on the study, Dr. Nicholas Jacobson, to harness artificial intelligence to make the chatbot smarter and perhaps be able to better address, you know, comorbid concerns like depression and anxiety. You know, as you heard me say, we didn't really unfortunately make a dent in those problems, but we're hopeful by having, you know, sort of a more flexible chatbot in the future, we might be able to. But I think that for the time being, you know, while chatbots are still somewhat in their infancy, you know, they're really good for like a defined purpose. So something else my team is doing is we're also working with Anita to develop and test a chatbot that could be paired for individuals who screen positive on the NIDA screen, if they actually have like a clinical eating disorder. So they're more than just at risk. And we find that they're not in treatment, giving them a chatbot to even increase their motivation for care and help provide some tailored recommendations for what kind of care options even exist. Because, you know, access to treatment for eating disorders is a huge problem. You know, 80% of people never get any kind of help. And in eating disorders, there can be a lack of motivation for treatment sometimes, which is unlike other psychiatric disorders. These disorders can be what we call really egocentric. You know, they feel like part of who you are. And there can be a lot of hesitancy around kind of quote unquote giving up the eating disorder. So right now we're currently working on, developing and testing this chatbot that may also help to motivate you for treatment and get you into treatment if you have more of those clinical levels of concern. Because the chatbot in the paper we've been talking about is, again, more for those high-risk people.
How do we get from this research to applied solutions?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, this is one of the best case situations I've ever encountered in my work, you know, where I talked about, you know, we actually have the opportunity here, you know, sort of within months of publication of a paper to immediately deploy our chatbot in the real world, you know, via this partnership with the National Eating Disorders Association and X2AI. So I think that that is, you know, really exciting. And I think that overall, it's really important for researchers to always have at the forefront of their minds, you know, how am I going to have these findings make a difference? You know, how am I going to apply my work? Or at least that's always a passion of mine. So I think it's really important to consider from the outset when you're designing interventions, including digital ones, you know, to really design them for dissemination and have a plan for that from the get-go. And, you know, we're really thrilled that that worked out so smoothly for us this time around, which of course isn't always the case, but we're really fortunate to have amazing partners in, you know, NEDA, the National Eating Disorders Association, and X2AI.
You touched upon this a little bit. What are the next steps for this research and your research and your team? What do you hope comes out of this, and where do you go from here?
So I think, you know, next step for this specific line of work is absolutely working to make the chatbot, you know, smarter and more flexible so individuals can have, you know, deeper conversations with it and it can, you know, respond to more complex sentiments from folks. And, you know, my colleague, Dr. Jacobson, and I are really excited to hopefully pursue that. We're currently in the process of trying to obtain funding for that work. So we definitely hope, you know, that's on the near term for us. And I think overall, you know, my team is just really committed to developing and testing digital solutions to address this just enormous treatment gap that we see in eating disorders with, you know, so few people having access to care, you know, and there are certain populations where that problem is even worse, you know, for example, individuals from lower income backgrounds or those who are on Medicaid or public insurance, you know, those individuals have oftentimes, you know, really no access to treatment because we have so few providers in our country, you know, trained in these problems. Many people can feel intimidated to treat individuals with these problems. So, you know, we also, through a project that's also being funded by NEDA, my colleague at the University of California, San Francisco, and I, her name's Dr. Erin Accurzo, we're going to be developing a mobile intervention for lower income individuals with binge type eating disorders like bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorders. So we're really excited about that line of work. Okay. And I also, have another project that is just launching where we're developing and testing a mobile app to support women with anorexia nervosa after acute treatment. So after they're in treatment, like inpatient or residential treatment, because we see such very high relapse rates after that kind of treatment, you know, 50% or more of people will relapse. And so we're really interested, you know, whether having this kind of like in the moment app-based support could help to address that massive problem that we have in our field of individuals, you know, relapsing. So those are, you know, two projects that are, you know, in the works that we're really excited about. And those are some of the highlights.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us about your amazing research and congrats on the success that you've seen so far. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Coming up next, we talk about what a trove of Slavic text adventure games from the 80s can tell us about that time in the history of the region. After this. Here with us is Miroš Brojo, General Manager at Slovak Game Developers Association and Curator at the Slovak Design Museum. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, everyone. Happy to be here.
So tell us about the Slovak Game Developers Association and what your role is there.
Yeah, so well, our association is a civic association, an NGO that was established several years ago by Slovak developers to basically cater to their needs, you know, to have a common voice. We have several members, almost 30 now. We've been active for 4 or 5 years now. We organize a lot of events, a game conference. We publish an annual census of Slovak game developers with various statistics, then also some catalogs for promotional purposes, help with getting better with education in Slovakia and so on and so on. So it's a lot of activities, basically everything we can do in our power to make game development easier in Slovakia.
So tell us about this multimedia collection of 1980s text adventure games you pitched to the Slovak Design Museum and you're curating there now.
I mean, obviously, there's a lot of people around the world in other countries that already are doing academic research and professional research when it comes to history of digital media, multimedia and video games. I sort of had this dream to start something like this in Slovakia too. I had some friends in the Slovak Design Museum, so I proposed them this idea that I had, that we should maybe start a multimedia collection, and within that collection, maybe I could be working on some historical research of Slovak games. And we started doing research, basically. And it's been going on for 2 or 3 years now. We have a huge list of Slovak games that before I didn't had any idea that there were more than 1,000 games in Slovakia, which is a country of only 5 million people with a fairly short history. So slowly we've been preserving all these games, contacting their original authors, gathering documentation and various other activities. An exhibition is also planned.
And how did you uncover these games?
Well, you know, to be honest, it's not that romantic as some people imagine. It's not really, you don't really search for cassettes or CDs on some people's attics or I don't know where. But basically, there are these huge communities of people that already do this for you and have been doing this for years, because every platform, for example, has its own fan base. So the ZX Spectrum computer, Atari computer, or the NES console or Super Nintendo console, they're big fan bases and communities on the internet where they gather all the information that they can, and they also already do some preservation and copies, you know, and backups. So what we actually had to do first and foremost is to crawl through all these databases and find all these people and communities online, and then somehow be able to identify which of those games that are already archived online unprofessionally but still better than nothing are from Slovakia. And that's basically where we started. And then moving from there, we contacted some of the authors of the games, and they remembered that they might have some hard drives or floppy disks still at home, and they checked, and we also found some of the games like this. But I would say that 95% of all the games were basically already archived by the fan communities online, which is really awesome, because, you know, we started doing this 10, 15 years ago when none of the researchers and multimedia historians even cared about video games. But it's changing now. I mean, there's a huge interest nowadays, so we are slowly like flipping from the fan approach to the professional history and preservation type of approach.
One of the things that really like struck me about this exhibit was not only that it's computer games from the 80s, but it's computer games from Slovakia. And I'm wondering for our non-Slovakian listeners, if you can kind of describe what the computing scene was like in the 80s in Slovakia. I'm curious what kind of computers were common. Were computers very common in people's homes? What platforms were used? How did people even get games?
Well, first and foremost, we had no consoles over here because they were not worth importing. One of the main reasons, or I would say there are two reasons, the socialist regime was not really interested in games, and they didn't consider this to be, you know, a valuable thing to import and to sell in Slovakia. So there were no Nintendos or Super Nintendo consoles imported. But also another important reason, I mean, they could have been smuggled into Slovakia. That's something that was done fairly often. but people weren't really interested in them because the storage media of these consoles were cartridges and they couldn't be copied so easily.
Right.
And ordering cartridges from abroad when an average salary in the Eastern Europe was several times smaller than in Western Europe was basically something unthinkable because it would cost you like half of your monthly pay. So that's why we didn't have consoles, but we had some computers. We even had our own computers here. One of the first ones was PMD85, manufactured in Didaktik Skalica. Skalica is a small town in Slovakia. So this was a factory directly in Slovakia that was manufacturing this 8-bit computer. But the most popular platform and the most popular computer was ZX Spectrum. It was quite popular in Europe. And it was often smuggled into Slovakia from Germany. It didn't run on cartridges. It ran on regular audio cassettes that you could easily copy. So this was one of the reasons. You actually connected it to a player and then you just, you know, pushed the play button and you had this sound like a dial-up internet connecting and was loading a program from a cassette. So this was a computer that there were several thousand people in Slovakia that had these computers. And then we also started manufacturing our own clones of ZX Spectrum, which were called Didaktik Gamma and Didaktik M computers. These were two models. Then there was also Didaktik Compact that already used floppy disks. But these first two models, they used cassettes, like I mentioned. And they were fairly easy to manufacture because there were Russian clones of the processor that ZX Spectrum used, and it was very easy to replicate. So this is what we went with. And then we had, it's a wild guess, but I would say that we had around several tens of thousands of computers in the 80s, especially those Didaktiks and ZX Spectrums. Then we sort of skipped the 16-bit era in the 90s, and people slowly started transitioning around 1995, 96 to regular 86 PCs.
So why did you feel it was important to feature this collection of games from the region?
I mean, I don't know why is it important to actually showcase anything that comes out of your country as is important personally for you as part of your culture heritage. I mean, for me, it doesn't really matter if it's games, if it's, I don't know, some sort of fashion, books, paintings, films, can be anything. I mean, if I would be a film buff first and foremost, I would probably be trying to do the same for films. But since the game is my go-to medium, that's why I started doing this with games. And I think we are the last, I don't know, 10 years, there's like this big transformation when it comes to perception of games. More and more people are starting to accept games not only as means of entertainment, but also as something that can have its own cultural, artistic, or narrative value, that can communicate some interesting ideas. And even though these games were often fairly simple in the beginning, as with any other media or art form, it is our important part of our history. And I don't know, let's say if we will have like very, very artistically valuable games in 10, 20, 30 years, we will definitely want to know how the beginnings of the medium looked. We already know this about, let's call it, quote unquote, global history of games. There are a lot of books written about the US part of history of games, also about the Japanese part of the history, which were the two countries that were dominant in the arcade era. But slowly, people are also starting to show more interest into these so-called local histories of various media. So also with games, I mean, the history is obviously always written by winners and by the most dominant producers of the medium, but every country also has some small part to play too. So this is our small part, the Slovak part.
One of the really cool things about the exhibit is that not only are the games available to play in their original language, but you've also gone ahead and translated a lot of them into English. And I'm curious how you selected which games to feature and which games to translate.
The most important thing, first and foremost, for us was that we only selected text adventure games because these should be the type of games that should be able to carry the most amount of, you know, meaning and meaningful information about the period in which they were created. From this period, we also have, I don't know, platformer games or action games, but these don't really need translation. You know, you can get fairly easily through the menus, even if you don't speak Slovak. But when it comes to text adventures, where the whole point of the game is reading through an interactive text. You really need to understand what you're reading and what you're playing. So the first condition was that all the games will be text adventures. And then another one will be, I mean, and this is not something that's already in the public domain. It's 35-year-old games. So we still needed to get the confirmation, you know, license agreement for translations from the original authors. So then also another important condition was if we even were able to find the authors, you know. So some of the games that we would like to translate, we really can't because, I don't know, the author, maybe we know the name, but his name is so common that there are 150 people in Slovakia with that name, so we can't really find him. But in the end, we managed to find like maybe 80% of the people. It's sort of creepy, but you know, everyone is on LinkedIn or on some other social media. You can find almost everyone nowadays without any problems. Last but not least, since we already worked and we had a colleague, Stano Hrda, which was one of the members of the whole project team, which is actually the author of one of the games, Shatohin. He has very good historical knowledge and context. We also based the selection partially on his recommendations.
Let's talk about the exhibit and the museum. How are these games being curated? I'm really interested how are they stored? How are they presented at the museum and online as well?
They're not really curated. I mean, right now we have the approach of basically trying to gather everything that was created in Slovakia, staying neutral when it comes to judging the quality of the production and the games, and trying to get as many games, as much documentation as we can, all the box arts, computers and stuff, basically like preparing the collection and everything that we collected for someone that would do like a curated approach that could write, I don't know, a book on the history, decide what the most important pieces of software were in Slovakia. We're still not there yet. We have a lot of work when it comes to gathering, so we're not really selecting what is important and what is not important. Everything is important for us right now. When it comes to storing the games, we have a server in the museum, a local server with two backups. So it's not really like, I don't know, a vault where WikiLeaks stores all this information. It's a very simple solution. But we are also thinking about if we should start thinking about, you know, long-term storages on those big capacity cassettes that are used nowadays for long-term storage, which is something that we will definitely be looking into further on.
What was significant about the specific games to be the first 10 to be translated and featured? Anything special about them?
One of the games is important because it makes fun of the regime. It has a very dark black humor. Rambo is there. So that's something that's very cool and might be quite interesting because it showcases how the Western culture impacted Eastern European culture in the 80s already. There is another game about stealing half of the recipe of Pepsi-Cola, which is another example of how the Western culture was already slowly spreading in the East, even before the fall of the socialist regime. There were some games that were technically quite interesting, where you don't only input regular commands like go left, go right, but you actually can have some sort of a dialogue and so on and so on. So I would say that it's very individual depending on each of those games.
What were the political ramifications of these games at the time?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's not really that romantic, as some people might imagine. Basically, games were ignored by the socialist state in the 80s. It wasn't the dominant medium. It wasn't super widespread since there was no official distribution. Nobody sold software in the stores in Slovakia. This was only part of a very small and enthusiastic homebrew community. I don't know why it wasn't like in the US where everyone already played on consoles or played arcades in the 80s. In Slovakia, it was several thousand people or several thousand kids ranging from 15 to 20 years old, which is also, I would say, the average age of all the authors of the games that we translated. So these games were not really that widespread to be noticed. So no ramifications at all.
You mentioned that you were able to track down many of the developers. Are there any common themes about the people that developed these games at the time? And I'm kind of curious, like how they made them.
Yeah, they were pretty much labors of love. You couldn't really monetize it in any way because there was no way of officially distributing and manufacturing those copies. So these were most of the times people in their teens that somehow got to a computer, or their parents bought them a computer and they slowly started to tinker with it. They got their hands on some games from other countries and they started thinking that maybe I could also create something like this. And they started experimenting with programming. And then they were shared among friends, and the friends shared those games with other friends. And this is how the games spread. You know, this is also why they stayed under the radar. You couldn't really buy them in stores. And then also there is another interesting common theme, but not at the time of the development when it comes to the people that developed it. But in the present, when I was getting in touch with most of them, I got in touch with like 20 or 30 people that created games back then. Most of them actually ended up as programmers, which is really cool, I think. And yeah. A lot of them even made it into big companies like Microsoft or Cisco and, you know, all these really global players when it comes to IT and software. So you can actually see on this example how when you have a really cool hobby, it can grow into something really, really cool and useful when you grow up.
Thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Dev News. This show is produced and mixed by Levi Sharp. Editorial oversight is provided by Peter Frank, Ben Halpern, and Jess Lee. Our theme music is by Dan Powell. If you have any questions or comments, dial into our Google Voice at +1-929-500-1513 or email us at pod@dev.to. Please rate and subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts.